Saybrook's Department of Integrative Social Work is committed to preparing outstanding social work professionals who will serve as inspirational leaders, change agents, and teachers in public health, healthcare, the corporate world, and academia. Prepare to advance your career within the professional field of social work and leverage your expertise to initiate transformational change in organizations and communities toward a more just, humane, and sustainable world. Learn more at saybrook.edu. Hey everyone! Today's episode of Saybrook Insights is a rebroadcast of our Women in Leadership panel presentation, hosted by the Division of Student Affairs and University Relations. We were pleased to have a candid discussion with these outstanding women leaders who serve across multiple industries. Our panelists included Dr. Rhondra Willis, Dr. Carla Sapp, Dr. April Taylor, Sarah Koenig, Amy Evans, and Sally Bell. Special thanks to Ms. Carmen Bowen and Dr. Shanice McGill for all their efforts in bringing this to fruition. Enjoy this robust discussion and have a great listen. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Women in Leadership Panel at Saybrook University. My name is Carmen Bowen. I am the Director of University Relations, and I am one of your co-facilitators, along with my partner, Dr. Shanice McGill. Welcome, Dr. McGill.
Hi, Carmen. Hello. Hi, everyone.
Okay, so today we're going to be working with a distinguished panel of ladies, and we're going to let them introduce themselves. So we will begin with Dr. April Taylor. Welcome, Dr. Taylor. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Ms. Bowen. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Dr. Taylor. I'm the Dean for the College of Arts and Sciences at South University. It's my pleasure to be with each of you this evening and looking forward to an empowering, uplifting discussion with my fellow colleagues on the panel and with all of you that have joined us today.
Thank you very much. I would now like to invite Amy Evans.
Hello, everybody. It's really an honor to be here with you today. My name is Amy Evans. I am the president of Calibri Insurance Services, which is an employee benefits agency in the Los Angeles area. I work with small businesses to help them figure out employee benefits. And I'm also the founder of Align Women, which is a leadership and networking organization for professional women. And that includes my role as host of the Align Women podcast. I'm really honored to be with you and to learn from the other panelists today.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you coming today. All right, let's welcome Sarah Koenig.
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Sarah Koenig, also honored to be here. I run my own financial services practice, also based out of the Los Angeles area. I am really grateful to Carmen for inviting me. I'm a member of the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce and active in the community here, and a fellow alumna of a women's college, and just really honored to be a part of this. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. I would now like to welcome Dr. Rhondra Willis.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you, Carmen, for the invite. I'm so happy and honored to be here. I'm an intelligence specialist with the Naval Criminal Investigative Service, also known as NCIS, like the TV show for people who are wondering. And I'm a part-time senior adjunct chairing dissertation students at Grand Canyon University.
Thank you so much. I would now like to welcome panelist Sally Bell.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. I'm actually a former student of Dr. Mary Kay Chess, who's on faculty there at Saybrook, and she's been a mentor for a long time, so it's a real privilege to speak here today. I'm Sally Bell. I'm Vice President and Executive Director for the Technology Association of Oregon. So I know many of you are down in California. I'm just to the north of you here in Oregon. We are a statewide organization for the tech industry in Oregon. We work with about 500 companies statewide doing policy and advocacy work. We did about 165 events last year, most of them on Zoom. So pretty familiar with this platform. And we do a lot of visibility and business support across the tech industry. So really nice to see you all here today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Last but certainly not least, Dr. Carla Sapp.
Hello, everyone. I am Dr. Carla Sapp. I am a licensed professional counselor in Georgia, as well as a licensed mental health counselor in the state of Florida, where I own my own private practice. I'm a fierce mental health and social justice advocate who works full-time with the Federal Bureau of Prisons as a drug abuse program coordinator. And I am excited to be here with this distinguished panel on today to discuss leadership and women.
All right, thank you so much. Well, we've introduced our panel, and so now I will turn over the questioning part to my partner and co-facilitator, Dr. Shanice McGill. And Dr. McGill, please tell them about you as well.
Oh, sure. My name is Dr. Shanice McGill. I am the Dean of Students here at Saybrook, and I do it all, except for financial aid and registrar stuff. So that saves me a little bit. But thank you all for joining us today. And thank you to, especially to our panelists for taking the time out of your day to share and give our community some insight as to who you are and how you maneuver through your positions. So the first question that we have is, how has the pandemic changed how you do business? And feel free to chime in. There is no particular order that we're going. Whoever wants to start with that question first.
I don't mind starting, Dr. McGill. So I work in higher education. I'm the dean for two colleges, and we know the higher education landscape certainly changed because of the pandemic. We at South University, we had classes on campus and we had classes online. One of the things we had to start was a South VR panel, which is our virtual remote offering. So we had to maneuver to find in different ways to offer education, to continue to make it interactive, and to continue to have it being the hands-on learning experience people are used to, that our students are used to in a virtual space. That was a fairly large change for us. We already had some classes we were offering in that manner. It was expanding and then getting everyone trained. We had some instructors that couldn't wait to go, absolutely excited about the technology, and some that were a little bit more timid about using the technology. So it was an experience in getting everyone used to this is the way forward. We didn't know how long COVID would last, and more than a year later, we're still here. So it certainly shifted the way in which we did business and offered classes to students. And I'm certain Saybrook had a very similar experience.
From the mental health perspective, as we know with COVID in the pandemic, it brought about a lot of emotions and took a toll on a lot of people. And while a lot of individuals were, you know, used to the traditional counseling, being in the clinical setting, having to kind of redirect and go to telehealth. And so being able to set up electronic health records and find platforms that was conducive to being able to provide the services that were safe and secure, being able to work with clients to understand the technology aspect of virtual counseling and how to integrate. I know for a lot of my colleagues, being able to work with children has been one of those that has been such a huge transition, and being able to keep them engaged in the session, finding things that they can do virtually. And so being able to move from traditional to non-traditional, but at the same time, see that shift to where a lot of individuals now are thinking, hey, this is something that's going to kind of last longer. And moving from having traditional offices to having kind of that home space where you're doing virtual, but if you need to have an office, happening for those periods of time.
I have a question for you, Carla. Have you noticed that with the onset of the pandemic and, you know, different states having stay-at-home orders and things like that, have you noticed an increase in clients and the duration that people would normally work with a clinician to help process some of the things that they're going through?
I would definitely have to say that, you know, over the course of the year, you've seen an increase. A lot of individuals who did not necessarily look to mental health as an avenue during this time have, given the significant losses that have incurred, family members, jobs, finances, and just the whole sense of normalcy. Just life as we've known it for the past year has not been what we knew a year ago. And so that has been so, for some, devastating, for some, tumultuous, for some, chaotic, and being able to make that transition. And so you're finding now that the number of individuals seeking counseling services have increased to the point where, you know, you have platforms now like BetterHelp, Talkspace. They're providing these services as well. And from my understanding, it's a never-ending surplus of clients. And so the clients are there. It's just meeting them in those avenues and those mediums for them to be able to get the services. A lot of them are feeling a lot more comfortable because I can do it in my home and I don't have to worry about someone seeing me going into the counseling practice or somebody knowing that I'm receiving services. So having some sense of anonymity and not feeling that they're kind of exposed at this point has also kind of normalized the counseling process.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought about that before, and people feeling stigmatized by walking into an office that's identified in a particular way. It's very interesting. Sarah, were you moving to unmute yourself earlier before I asked Carla that follow-up question?
Yeah, I mean, no particular order, but I figured I could chime in and answer the question.
Absolutely.
Yeah, for me, from a financial advising standpoint, like, the pandemic certainly shifted the way we do business, not only in like the physical sense of like, I can no longer go to people's houses or invite them into my office. So all of my meetings shifted to being on Zoom, which created a lot of changes. Like for me, particularly allowed me to see more people in a day because I didn't have any travel time. I could do meetings like back to back or just have 5 minutes in between them. And it really increased my capacity, which was quite a blessing because as people lost their jobs and as transitions happened and people passed away, like the need for financial services has like really been at an all-time high, and I have to say I'm very blessed. At the same time though, I feel like the way that I do business has shifted more so even like on an emotional standpoint of like the needs of people that I'm servicing are more intense. And there's a lot of like fear and uncertainty and maybe doubts around like what people's futures look like in a physical sense and then also in a financial sense of like, how are we gonna plan for this if we don't know what's going on, right? So I found that over the past year, one of the things I've really developed within myself is this ability to connect with clients on a more heart-to-heart level. And like, we share things that like prior to this wasn't really part of my practice or business at all. So that's what it's been like for me.
Interesting. I hadn't thought about it from that perspective of dealing with the emotional aspect, especially in your role, because when I think of finances, I think of, you know, how much money can I spend this week at the mall or how much money I should not spend on Amazon and, you know, that sort of thing. But I guess this pandemic does raise a different sense of the needs of people and how we go about navigating that. Thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely.
Would any of the other panelists like to chime in?
Yeah, I'd love to chime in.
Sure. Hi, Sally.
Hi. So I work with the tech industry, and the majority of the members in our organization are large tech companies like Google and Facebook and Intel and Nike. And so what I've gotten to see is really the underbelly of their experience in transitioning to remote work in the pandemic, which has been really interesting. And so as you would think, these highly capable large companies are, you'd think that them transitioning to fully remote would be like completely turnkey. You know, many of them have struggled. I mean, this is like a human challenge, right? In terms of how we balance it. I think a lot of companies in the technology industry already had a lot of tech tools in place, right? Like, you know, workflow systems, and whether they're using Slack or all these different software platforms to keep in communication. I think that the biggest impact we've seen, honestly, and this is the theme of today, obviously, is just the impact on women.
And so the majority of folks that I work with are, you know, C-suite and executives within tech. Many of them are juggling, you know, the four jobs of the pandemic, which is their assigned job, their role as a parent, their role in the home, and, you know, their role in like the other section and slice of life, which is maybe volunteer work or community work, which is so important in the pandemic. And so I've definitely experienced a lot of conversations with women, and I'm sure we'll get to this later in the conversation, is just ultimately how we're balancing. And the remote work piece is, the work piece is only really a sliver of the whole equation in our life experience of living, learning, working remotely.
So with that, let's segue into that question. That was one of the questions that we have for everybody on the panel in terms of, how are you balancing work and life? Is there even a such thing as balance, especially as a lot of us are still on stay-at-home orders? What are you doing to help, you know, keep yourself centered and focused during this time?
I'll chime in there.
Hi, Amy.
I really like the phrase work-life integration more than work-life balance, because balance to me implies some sort of mathematical equation that I don't experience. I will acknowledge that I am fortunate that I don't have children, and so I have not had to integrate the educate from home experience that I know a lot of people have. And I know that that's a challenge on top of a challenging situation. I have found that in the past year, I have slowed down a lot. I need a lot more breathing room, a lot more transition time from project to project or meeting to meeting. And I've also given myself permission to let go of the defined work hours and work times that I previously brought to the way I ran my business. Mm-hmm. So I get to work later than I used to. I take more time in the morning to read and journal and go about my home and water my plants and talk to my orchids and open my house up and get my day started from a personal standpoint before I feel like I have to sit down and plug into the rest of the world. And I take strange times off in the middle of the day to work on projects or go run errands or do other things that I have the space to do. And then I work through the weekends. A lot of times there's not a Friday afternoon shut everything down and a Monday morning start everything up again. It's much more in flow. And for me, that feels really good. It allows me to work when I feel productive, as opposed to when somebody else thinks I'm supposed to be productive. And that has been, I think flow is a really good word. If I'm calling it work-life integration, I think flow would be the other word I would apply to that. So that's the experience that I've been able to really enjoy in the last year.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that, Amy.
Can I add? Or is this for the panel to speak now?
No, if you have something to contribute, feel free.
I'm Sean Haynes. I'm Native and Creator, Please Be With Our Land and our acceptance of each other during these times. I'm with Seabrook, but I also work with the WHO during this COVID pandemic. And so I've been fortunate enough to be able to connect with the UN through it. What I notice about women, you see, I come from a history that's more like a longhouse. I'm Iroquois. And so when we look at complexity and women leading, my job is to respond as a woman ethically around COVID. So I've got 167 points I was writing last night about things we can improve on, because
when you have complicated responses in countries, and it's complicated. But we're anywhere from the food bank to the schools to the buses to the workplace, it's just complicated. So in our native community, I often have a saying, there's no circle on the turtle shell, which literally, when you look at a turtle shell, there's no circle on it. And that's a phrase that when I'm working with my colleagues in psychology, we have to longhouse this. We have to think in layers and complexities of community as women. And we, of course, have a role for our men and, you know, gender equity and all of that. But when we look at COVID and we look back on it years from now, and the role of women, I mean, the UN spoke, you know, we've had Canadian leaders, all of that. But we have to really look at the complexity of leadership. One of the things that came up for me when I'm, you know, visiting community, women are known to be strong, but let's get past that. As I'm talking to the workplace, and I go, you mean the workplace wasn't on the same platform as the WHO when this started for OHS, occupational health and safety? And they said, no. I said, well, that's a big mistake. And so when we look at the analytics of this and women's capacity to do analytics and the quickness of it, and there's a history of analytics and quickness. So when we look at, you know, I'm so proud of the women through COVID. I mean, it's horrendous. But we have to not deny the depth of what this is and our role as women. I've had invitations across cultures and, you know, all over the place during COVID. But it really, I mean, we had racism, we had water problems, we had food. I mean, it couldn't have been more complex. I mean, can you get to the door? Can Amazon deliver a package without me wiping my hands? Do I even have wipes to wipe my hands? It was really complicated. And one of the things we're good at, much like sitting around as women, who's missing? For me, what I found in Canada, it was the workplace. We didn't have enough masks. This is what we were doing on the reserve. We'd have our little Facebook channel. Hello, do you guys have any masks? Yeah, I have some here. I'll go get them. We just ship back and forth. We were doing everything on Facebook. Well, the WHO isn't on Facebook in the middle of COVID. So we got CDC and WHO organized the Native psychologists on the same platform as the WHO. It was an electronic horror. I was also in the classroom. You know, 300 students walking around. Oh, we have COVID. So we covered the water fountains and all of this, and I'm coming and going, and kids are scared. Are my friends okay? And we're communicating back and forth and having video assemblies. And then, oh, our platform where we meet our kids isn't working. Like, it was a real electronic problem. And so
within that, Sean, you brought up a good point. One of the questions that we also have for the panelists, and borrowing your terminology, Amy, of work-life integration, is how have your personal lives changed, if at all, during the pandemic? I know for a lot of our students in casual conversation, I've learned, you know, the importance of self-care and carving out that time to still connect with family and friends in a meaningful way. I would invite the panelists at this time to share a little bit about, you know, how this has manifested itself in your personal life in ways that you're finding to still, you know, feel like yourself in the midst of all that's going on with the pandemic.
I'll jump in if that's okay.
Oh, sure. Hi, Rondra.
Oh, hi. It was a bit difficult for me in the beginning to navigate homeschool and still working and trying to manage it all. And it was stressful, like it is for everyone. So some of the things that I was involved in was, for example, a happy hour with my friends. You know, you could bring your own beverage, water, coffee, tea, whatever. It was a good way to connect with some friends that I haven't had a chance to see. I even had organized a cooking class with my mother. She taught us all how to make egg rolls. So it was a way to kind of break up the monotony of the day-to-day grind of school and work. I also started reaching out for help. When I say reaching out for help, I hired a tutor for my daughter to help her because it was a lot for me to learn fourth grade math. I had no idea.
We are in the same boat, Rhonda.
Yes, the new math blew my mind completely. Yes. And so I needed to reach out for help. I have a coach. We have tutors. We have, you know, Dr. Carla was talking about mental health and, you know, making sure that my daughter, although she, you know, she's still in school, I don't want her mental health affected. So we were trying to find ways to break up the day-to-day. Everything is one thing. There's no separation. So, you know, I try to look for events that we can do online or go outside to a park and just break it up so that we stay healthy, although we're trying to stay safe.
I would like to, you know, add it, at the beginning of the pandemic, I was in the process of moving from Georgia to Florida, having been promoted to a new job, which made it a lot difficult because in that process of moving, things were shutting down. And so it was kind of almost in this place where it felt isolated and alone in the move. But then throughout the course, being able to stay connected via FaceTime and Zoom and having my journal, just like Amy was talking about, but even more so importantly, just having that kind of alone time to meditate for myself, I found was so important to be able to kind of maintain what I consider to be my safe place, my sanity, my mental health place. So I think that that's so important. But at the same time, I think, too, in the pandemic, so much happened. We found that not just were we experiencing a pandemic, but we saw so much racial tension that started to take place in the world, which kind of almost catapulted me to some degree into the mix of things with one of those happening back at home in Brunswick, Georgia, which then kind of made things a little harder in trying to navigate it and being able to understand my place in the world in that moment, helping my kids understand their places in the world in the pandemic. But then being who I am as a mental health advocate, mental health clinician, and being able to provide those services at the same time. So I feel, you know, it was kind of one of those things where it's been really a peculiar time where everything that could have happened that you would have never expected to happen happened. And it was kind of navigating the waters, treading, but at the same time, knowing when to take a break, knowing when to say, you know what, this is my moment to pause. This is my moment to kind of give myself a chance to breathe and have some me time.
Agreed, Carla. And, you know, Rhonda raised something that was important in my personal life. It was making sure that my daughter was okay. It was watching how the pandemic affected children. Near and dear to my heart was how would young people react to being in a virtual space. I have an almost teenager, we're 2 weeks away. And it was trying to ensure that she felt safe, she felt okay, her learning style had changed. We were in a brand new school district at the time, so we were getting to know new teachers as well. It also made me more intentional about my time. I had to start saying, this is work time. This is time for me to spend with my husband. This is time for me to spend with my child. And it made me intentional about my relationships and fostering those, because in the beginning, just trying to get used to a different space, some friendships fell off, and the communication you had when you'd go out and have an afternoon with your girlfriends, that wasn't happening anymore because we were all scared and scared to pass something on to each other. So we had to shift to taking care of each other in a space that was virtual, doing outreach to say, I still care about you, even if I can't see you in the way that I used to. I remember my first girlfriend's meeting was 8 of us FaceTiming each other and trying to do a group FaceTime, which on another occasion before COVID would have been all of us getting together to have an afternoon lunch or dinner. And so relationships changed, but I think I became very intentional about how I spent time with my family, protecting that time and being more mindful of what my little girl was going through and experiencing. and trying to make space for all those different things going on during the pandemic.
So very true. My daughter is also in the fourth grade, Rondra, and I don't like being a fourth grade teacher, nurse, chef, dean. It's a lot, especially because the way math is taught now is so, so different. So I definitely understand what you and April are saying in terms of trying to make sure that they're good and making sure that we find ways to connect so that we're also good for ourselves so that we can continue to be good for them. Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so the next question that we have for our panelist is, what are some of the pros and cons to working remotely that you've experienced? I know, Amy, you talked a bit about flow and kind of working when it feels natural for you. Does anyone else have any additional insight or perspective they would like to share in terms of some of the pros and cons of working remotely and what that looks like for them?
I can share. For me, I also am in this similar boat to Amy, whereas I don't have any children, which has made things a lot easier for sure. But I would say one of the biggest benefits for me in working from home is the lack of commute. And I've really been able to kind of capitalize more on the time in the morning for myself and really setting myself up during those early morning hours for success and not feeling rushed because I don't have to be out of the house at a specific time. I don't need to have breakfast done at a specific time. I do see a lot of value in still scheduling my work hours, which I do. They vary a little bit day to day, but generally I try to work from like 9 until 4. And then keeping that in that window, right? I know a lot of colleagues have shared with me that like work just seems to expand and it's like 24 hours a day and like I never stop working, and like there have been weeks for sure where I was like, wow, I'm really busy, and I'd end up working you know, late into the evening. And realizing kind of that we are in control of our own schedules and we get to manage that, and like, no, I'm not dealing with sitting in traffic anymore or like any accidents on the freeways or any of that kind of stuff. And I'm the one designing my schedule around when my clients are able to see me, and like I can control all of that. And it's really taught me a lot of lessons about time management. And like, personally, I'm really grateful. And I don't think in my industry specifically, things will, you know, they will transition. I will see people in person at some point again, but I think the idea of people being comfortable seeing their financial advisor over Zoom is just a lot more accepted now. And it's made it shifted the industry in a way that I personally really appreciate.
Thank you for that, Sarah.
Dr. McGill, the commute from the bed to the home office saving me so much gas. So I agree with you.
So much gas, so much time. The quality of life is so much different now. I didn't realize how much time I spent on the freeways until we got put on punishment.
But it was a good punishment for that only.
Yes.
Gas savings and commute.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Has anyone on the panel had any cons or not so great things that have come about as a result of working from home? I think most of us find the joys in the simple things like saving the gas and not having to spend hours commuting. But has anyone struggled with the transition to remote work?
I can touch base on that one. I am an extrovert by nature, which doesn't necessarily mean you're going to respond one way in this remote work environment, but I have definitely struggled because I really enjoy connecting with others in person. It's an energetic exchange, you know? And so that's been really difficult for me because I do so much relationship building in the work that we do. One of the other things that I do is a lot of policy and advocacy work. And so in most states currently, there is legislative session. So, and in almost all states, those legislative sessions are going on remotely, So imagine being a senator, a representative, and normally you're gathering in the Capitol, you're making decisions together, you're having folks like me come in and being able to testify in person and give really compelling testimony on things that are really important right now, like, you know, taxes and privacy and all these important issues that are at stake. And so it's really difficult to do policy work remotely. It is not the same. I do a lot of testifying and attend a lot of virtual hearings, and, you know, it's all being done on Zoom, you know? And so, you know, our policymakers and elected officials are doing their best. I think they're really struggling with doing that work remotely. And, you know, we're all doing our best to make sure that the right decisions are, you know, we're able to influence in all the right ways. But that part of our you know, operations has been definitely inhibited, I think, by the remote nature of things.
I have a couple of follow-up questions for you, Sally. So you started off saying, you know, I'm an extroverted person. So since, you know, we're all working remotely for the most part still, how have you found ways to still be yourself, even though you're remote, in terms of that interaction with folks? What does that look like for you now?
Yeah, really good question. I'm also a mother of two littles. I have a 3 and 5 year old. And so that sometimes consumes a lot of the interaction energy that I need during the day. But honestly, when it comes to colleagues and friends, which I do make a lot of time for, it feeds me to have more social time with them. I'm using different apps. So I'm a big fan of Marco Polo, which is an app which allows you to exchange video messages with, you know, some of my oldest friends to stay in touch. And it's, nothing is the same, but all these things are still keeping us buoyed and buoyant in that kind of, you know, energetic connection way. And so that's one thing that I've discovered. I don't think, if you had told me a year ago that I would be relying on Marco Polo to like feed my friendships, I would have just laughed. But it's actually a really great tool. So, you know, we all surprise ourselves.
Right. And the other question I have for you was, you shared that a lot of the advocacy work and lawmakers and testifying and things like that are happening virtually, and that our lawmakers are struggling with that transition from being in a shared space in this, you know, very clearly defined space of this is where business happens to now everything happening on Zoom. What would you say are some of the things that they're struggling with the most? Is it being able to feel someone's energy in person as they are making a case for X, Y, and Z? Or is it, you know, the technology? Like, I think we all saw the video where the lawyer called in for a court session. He's like, I'm here, I'm not a cat. What are some of the things that our lawmakers are struggling with as it relates to being in the virtual setting?
Yeah, I mean, I think when we look at the general demographic and profile of the majority of our policymakers, they're not digital natives. Things are changing. We're getting some younger folks into legislature, but they weren't born with technology in their hand. And so I do think that some of the platforms are just more cumbersome in terms of workflow. But I also think the way that, you know, lobbyists work with legislators is, you know, they're hanging out in the hallways of Capitol buildings during legislative session for like months on end, trying to get, you know, tell them this and get a word in here and plug this bill and this, you know, and none of that's happening for the lobbyists. So their job has gotten a lot harder. We work with a lot of lobbying firms for the work that we do. And I don't, you know, sometimes I don't feel all that badly for them because, you know, they can be difficult, but the nature of, you know, how decisions are getting made in policy right now are very different. And I think, you know, although it's very taxing for them to be in person for like months on end, you know, that's a really exhausting job. So I think there's a hybrid model going forward, you know, which gives people a little bit more of the break. And I think that's the silver lining.
Well, good. Anybody else want to address that question before I have one I want to ask? All right. So first of all, all of us as women
Well, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. But all of us that are women, we have a lot of challenges that we have had to overcome, you know, decade after decade, or century after century, before that. And now that we're leaders and movers and shakers in the workforce, we keep seeing all of these things that we knew to be true. And I know, Amy, we had a big session some years ago at one of our ladies' meetings about the workplace and the harassment, especially with the things that are going on within our political system, because, you know, Sally, you know, that's your wheelhouse, definitely. But talk to me about what you guys are feeling, especially when we see all the crass things that are being said from our former president, some current governors. You know what I'm talking about. Would anybody want to just tackle maybe that on the panel? Yes, go ahead, Amy.
Yeah, I'll tackle it from one angle. And Carmen, you and I have talked about this for a long time. One of the things I really like about this pandemic environment or this new world order, however we want to refer to it, is that I get to be much more selective, and someone else used the word intentional. I love that word. I get to be much more selective and intentional with where I spend my time and who I spend my time with. And for me, that allows me to eliminate a lot of the environments that I found to be really misogynistic and based on men's rules about the way men want to do business and power plays and inappropriate comments. And I would reference sort of professional networking events, which in Los Angeles are a very common way for people in a trusted advisor role like me, and I'm sure Sarah's had this experience, the way that we do business and get referrals. And those organizations are typically put together by men, run by men, mostly attended by men, and have a very masculine energy about them, where the person who's sort of the brashest and the loudest in the room gets most of the attention and therefore gets most of the business. And I have found that because those events don't really exist, I mean, they exist virtually, but it's a very different energy. I've been able to unplug from those and really downsize the circle of people that I support and do business with to be the people I really want to work with, which tend to be women. And even it has allowed me to build my own organization of networking for women and create an environment based on our rules and how we want to operate, as opposed to having to play by the rules that existed before. And I think this is a wonderful opportunity to say, I don't want to play by those rules anymore. I wasn't comfortable under those rules. That used to be the only thing that was available to me. But now I can build something that I want, or I can find somebody else who's built something that's more aligned with what I'm looking for, and leave some of that behind. I also kind of love that everything's recorded. So if someone wants to misbehave, they're probably going to pay for it. I've had a lot of really crummy comments made to me in meetings that I wish I could have had recorded. So, you know, now that it's on Zoom, be careful, because it's probably going to come back and bite you if you're going to misbehave with your female colleagues. And they've got that record button handy. So that's been my experience. I always like to look at things as an opportunity to create what I really want if what I had before didn't exist anymore. And so this has been a great opportunity for me to do that.
Thank you. Anyone else on the panel want to tackle that difficult question? All right, Dr. McGill.
Is that a panel only question, Carmen?
For right now, but you can put your questions in the chat.
Okay, so one of the questions that Carmen and I were talking about is, what are some characteristics of a good leader? from your perspectives as individual panelists from a variety of fields. And Roger, specifically, I'm really interested to hear your perspective on this. I assume, and you can tell me if I'm wrong with this assumption, that you work in a very male-dominated industry, and you probably deal with a lot of not-so-pleasant things. So I'm wondering, what are some of the characteristics that you all think make a really good leader in your industries?
I'll jump in if that's okay, Dr. McGill.
Oh, sure.
I do work in a very male-dominated organization and industry. And sometimes, as Amy said, sometimes the people who are the loudest and the brashest get the most attention and get more of what they want, not necessarily business, but get more of what they want in my field. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I find it difficult sometimes to compete, but I have found that since we've been in Zoom land, it's kind of leveled the playing field. Because now I don't necessarily have to compete as much because I'm doing the work from home, but I also have the benefit of working from home. So I have less issues with childcare concerns as far as getting my daughter to where she needs to be. Far as some of the best leaders that I've had, male and female, where I've been working in law enforcement intelligence, are people who are fair, they listen, and they're open. They don't just assume that the person who speaks the loudest has the best answer, or the person who has the most experience or the most rank is the best answer. And they give everybody a shot. Even the people who seem unlikely to maybe know the answer or be able to contribute, they're given the opportunity. And I think those types of leaders, they go the furthest because they build cohesion around the ranks and they don't ostracize particularly anybody, particularly women. And I've seen it done. You know, sometimes you'll say something or another woman maybe will say something or somebody who's not very loud or boisterous will say something and it'll be disregarded in a meeting. Then somebody else will say the exact same thing a different way and it'll be received. But I think a good leader is able to read between those lines and see the answers for what they are. And I think they just give everybody a chance. They listen fairly with an open ear. And I think that speaks volumes about the person themselves. And I will always follow somebody like that. Always support them, always follow them, and always uphold them and do my best to serve them and make them look good in the workplace.
Well said, well said.
I was just about to say that. Very well said, Roger. Well,
one of our, someone in our, on the chat said, preach it. Don't you all want to, we all wanted to say that in our own way. And I see a lot of the ladies on here shaking their heads, but even guys, I mean, it holds true for them. It happens. Just the alpha, well, you hate to say alpha males, but in our experience, they not only try to outshine the ladies, but they also try to outshine men as well. So certainly like that. All right. I'll turn it back over to you, Dr. McGill.
Sure. Before we move on, was there anyone else that wanted to share some of the characteristics that they believe make someone a good leader?
Integrity. It's one of the most important characteristics a good leader can have. When you have a sense of your ethics, where your beliefs lie, it governs how you treat other people, whether or not you're service oriented, whether or not you're leading from behind or you're the one out front charging. But when you have a sense of integrity, ethics, character, that's what we look for in good leaders. And we look for confidence. I'm feeling really happy about the number of women I can see in front of me exuding such confidence in this space and are happy with themselves and who they are. But we look for that in leaders, people who are confident and people who have a sense of values and their ethics, a sense of belief that governs how they relate to other people.
Indeed, indeed. Dr. Sapp, that's such a great question that Dr. McGill posed. Would you like to jump in on that one?
Just listening at Dr. April as well as with Dr. Rhonda, and just adding, you know, for me, and I was sitting here, I was thinking, you know, in my full-time job, I'm the only female in my department. I have a full staff of males, all five males, and it's just me at the helm. But one of the things that I've learned in working with them, and leading our program is that if I lead by example, they're going to follow. So I have to set that tone. And so I think that that's so important as a leader to set the tone that you're looking for. And like Dr. Taylor just said, that confidence, having that confidence in yourself, being able to understand who you are, understand what your role is, being able to how to enact and demonstrate that role, kind of put it into play so that others can kind of see it. I also think being a visionary is so important. A lot of times people don't realize that having a vision takes you a long way because you kind of know the goal, you know where you're working towards, and then you can lead others to that place as well, right there by their side. And so having that vision, kind of knowing where you're wanting to go with this thing, and being there, being supportive, being an encourager, being empathetic, all those things are so important because it humanizes you. And I think that that's one of the basic things that most people have to realize, that in leadership, you have to humanize yourself. You have to show that at the end of the day, while I may be a leader, I'm still just a person, and we're in this together.
Absolutely. Very well said. So another question that Carmen and I were talking about as we were thinking of how we wanted to, you know, structure the panel is we were talking about mentorship and reflecting, you know, on mentors that we've had in our personal and professional lives and how that has helped to shape who we are as women and what we bring to our leadership role. So one of the questions that we have for you all as panelists is, what is the importance of a mentor? Is it important to have a mentor? And what does that relationship look like for you?
Good question. Well, Sally, you want to start with that? I see you there, Miss Sally.
Absolutely. You know, one thing I didn't share is that I actually used to work in higher ed. So I worked at University of Oregon for 8 years, and I founded the mentorship program and led the Women in Business Initiative, which is really fun work. And so, you know, mentorship when you're a student is absolutely vital. I think one of the misconceptions about mentorship that maybe some of the panelists would agree with me about is that it has to come from one source. You know, we put so much, we put so much into what could this person be? You know, how can I derive all this value from kind of one relationship? And I think what gives a lot more breath in that and opportunity is really thinking about how can you derive mentorship from a variety of sources? You know, it can be much more sustainable. I think deep level mentoring can be, you know, very life-giving, and it's magical when you find it, but it's also gotta be an agreed upon thing, right? I think you have to find those people in your life and you know when it's the right opportunity to really develop something that's more consistent with them. But I'm a big fan of the model of, what do we call it? Just like a board of advisors for yourself, a personal board of advisors, where you're drawing on different forms of mentoring from colleagues and maybe superiors. And also, I think it's important to consider, you know, your juniors, you know, how are you having exchanges from folks that might report to you or that you're teaching or are your children? And really thinking about this portfolio of mentoring, about the skills that you want to develop, and really leaning into it where it's not always, you know, just this one-way relationship or one with one person.
Indeed. So what about you, Dr. April Taylor?
Well, I may embarrass Dr. Bird when I say this, but he has been such a fountain of good, solid advice throughout my career. When I think about people who want you to grow, that's usually what you're looking for in a mentor. Somebody who sees qualities in you that they believe in, and they're willing to extend to you some advice, some nuggets of good information that say, I see things in you that are worthy. I see you growing. I see you expanding. And you, in turn, give back that same energy to your mentor. You start to say all the things you see in that person. That encouragement they're giving you, mentoring is a two-way relationship. Yes, you're gaining advice, you're gaining insight from their experience. And that's something I've seen with Dr. Bird. He's always willing to share information with me. That's to encourage me and grow. And when you speak to people saying, you know, here, I've climbed the ladder and I'm willing to turn around and hold the ladder open for you, that's exactly what I got from that relationship. It's one of my best mentors.
You got me with a tear coming down. Dr. Bird is on this call. All right. So great. And it's so well deserved for him. What about you, Miss Amy?
Yeah, a couple thoughts around that. I really resonate with what Sally said about having different people in different places who serve as mentors for specific skills. I had someone in my insurance career who was a mentor for me in sales and taught me probably almost everything I know to help me be successful in my insurance career. I had someone who mentored me when I decided I wanted to become a health insurance broker, and she ran the department that I worked in when I went to work for a large national agency to kind of learn the ropes, and I could not be where I am now without her. I'd also love to offer two other perspectives on mentorship, or two other avenues that come off of that. One is advocacy, which I think is really, really important, especially for women. There's an active element of being an advocate for somebody that doesn't always exist in being a mentor for them, but an advocate in terms of helping someone navigate maybe a corporate career or a particular industry, and speaking up for them and looking for opportunities for them and advocating for them to move forward. And I think that's a wonderful thing to be able to bring somebody who's trying to advance their career or advance their opportunities. And then the other thing I'm really learning about now is peer coaching. So finding someone who maybe is in a similar industry or of a similar age or of a similar experience and maybe wants to improve the same skills I want to improve or get into the same, make the same career shift I want to make, and really forming a bond together where we can support each other to learn to listen better or learn to eliminate a habit that we don't want to have anymore. I'd love to recommend, since we're on a call that supports women, a book called How Women Rise by an author named Sally Helgeson, which was really a life-changing book for me. And it is about habits that women typically develop early in their careers that at some point stop serving them. And it is both a pointing out of those habits and then recommendations for how to break them and replace them with new habits that will allow you to move further. And peer coaching is one of the things that she really advocates for. And I'm learning how to incorporate that into what I do. And I feel like peer coaching and advocacy both kind of fall under the umbrella of mentorship.
Wow. You're right about that. Peer coaching is key. And that is something that we should really focus a lot on. I want to just see, what do you think, Miss Sarah? Because I know you know, when you're doing your own business now, peer coaching is a little difficult when you don't have all that group of people with you. Who do you use as a mentor?
Yeah, so it's a great question. I agree with Sally, going back to this idea of having different mentors for different areas of life. I for sure have implemented that. I do have a professional mentor, and she's somebody who does the same thing as I do, but it just has a couple years of experience on me. And I find a lot of value in working with her because there are certain things that I'm acquiring the experience in doing for clients that if someone who's a couple of years ahead of me or a couple of steps ahead in life has this experience of doing for 4, 5, 6 years, and I'm starting off doing the same thing, there's a lot that I can learn from her and incorporate into my business and my practice at a rate or a speed that would be much quicker than if I didn't have her and had to learn it all on my own. So the way that I see mentorship is you get to kind of multiply yourself and your capacity and your results to a, like a greater extent by working with a mentor versus kind of figuring everything out on your own.
Absolutely, absolutely. Rhondra, you want to take a stab at that?
Oh, I'd absolutely love to. Actually, one of my mentors is on the call, Shay Glover. I don't know if she'll speak and say anything, but I have to tell you that Shay has been an instrumental mentor in my life. She's been a friend. She showed me things that I probably would have never seen or would have taken me years to learn about the organization I'm in. She introduced me into conversations. She introduced me to people, into concepts, a way of doing things, and helped me with navigating my career. Well, you should think about putting in for this, or here are the pros and cons. She saw something in me at the time I didn't see in myself. You know, sometimes you get in those spots where you're like, oh, this is all it's going to be. But Shay saw more than that. She asked the hard questions and she pushed me and I learned and I continued. And I appreciate it. She just chimed in. So yeah, she's a fantastic mentor. She showed me what I hadn't seen in a long time, you know, and I obviously when women enter usually into a conference room for a meeting, we sit on the perimeter, you know, and then I get to see a woman, hey, she's a senior level woman. She's going to sit right at the table. She doesn't have to ask permission. Is it okay if she sits there? She belongs at the front of the table. Nobody's asking. She belongs there because she's achieved the rank and she's achieved the honor. And she, like I said, she's just an outstanding mentor. And I truly appreciate her. She has all those qualities that everybody just mentioned. And if you don't have a mentor, anybody's listening to the call, get 1, 2, 3, 4. Mentors are outstanding and will change your life, definitely. Thanks so much, Shay. And thanks, Carmen, for the opportunity to speak on it.
Oh, no problem. And you know what? We don't always get to hear our flowers while we're here on Earth. And so I'm glad you had that opportunity to thank your mentor, as well as Dr. Taylor to thank Dr. Bird. So this is so cool. Dr. Sapp, do you want to do that? And then I have a really good Saybrookian type question in just a second. You want to tackle that before I go to the next question?
Yeah, I'll jump in. So Dr. Taylor, I think, kind of just said it all. And so I feel like me saying anything at this point is kind of like, you know, anyway, Dr. Bird is definitely my mentor, has been my mentor. Dr. Bird was one of my first professors back at South University when he was teaching there, going through the clinical mental health program. So I am a product of Dr. Bird. And over the years, even during my program, I mean, he knows some of the struggles with just life, and he was there with me. He guided me. He talked to me. He encouraged me. He supported me. He paved the way. He showed myself, along with all the other students, that there were so many other avenues we could take. I can remember when I got my first job with the Federal Bureau of Prisons outside of my program, I called them because I, you know, in the counseling program, you don't think, hey, you'll have to shoot a gun to qualify for a job. And then I get this job where I have to go to the range and I've got to shoot a gun. And I called him and I was just like, look, you didn't teach me this part in the program of shooting a gun. And, you know, he talked to me and we kind of laughed and chuckled it off. But he has, you know, been that person who, when all else fails and I question where I am in this field, where I'm going in this field, if I'm even in the right space, I can look to him for that guidance. And so definitely would say, you know, he emulates what a mentor is and should be, has always done that. And so for that, I'm thankful.
That is so great. And he obviously thinks highly of you because he introduced me to you and Dr. Taylor. So that was great. Okay, so I'm gonna pose this question. And so Dr. McGill knows as well as Dr. Bird at Saybrook, we have a mind-body medicine program and a lot of the philosophies of that program spill into everything. And we were founded on humanistic psychology. So we try to think of the whole person. So this is a Saybrookian type question. What are some ways that you engage in self-care? Now that is, and it sounds so simple, but for women, it's so hard for us. What do you do? What do you engage in to help you with your self-care? Marinate. And let's see, I'm going to go back around to Sally.
I just unmuted. So I'm excited to share this. I don't know if anyone's picked up this newish book called Atomic Habits. I'll maybe share the link for a direct purchase, but I am not the publisher. I am not the writer, but I'm a big fan of it because what it talks about is layering your habits to really get you to that point of joy. And I think self-care is so much about reevaluating the habits, and that if you have goals, it's not necessarily about just those outcomes. It's your process for getting there, right? And the process is supported by all the habits, and that is a stack of choices you make all day long. And we have all these moments throughout our day to make choices. And I think for me, self-care is honestly having the clarity in the choices that I'm making for those habits, because I know this point in my life, the things that will contribute to healthy mind, healthy body, healthy family, and a good relationship with myself, honestly. And so this book really helped me kind of return to how I stack my habits throughout the day and how those really set me up for success. And it gives me the permission to make the time for the things that are difficult to make time for. You know, we're all wearing lots of different hats in a given day. And so, you know, I'm also constantly checking in with my colleagues and friends about their self-care and trying to support it in not a judgmental way. You know, there have definitely been days where friends like, are you doing self-care? And I just want to say, well, no, because I barely have time for anything. I barely have time, you know, between Zoom meetings. I barely have time to eat a meal or do the dishes or do the home stuff. But those habits, I think taking a moment to examine how they're all linked and where our motivations are, you know, are those habits serving us? That's been really useful lately around self-care piece.
Absolutely. Can you put the book in the chat for me? Because I thought that was really good. So Dr. Willis, you put in the chat about, you know, setting those boundaries, implement a hard stop. Would you talk a little bit about that? Because I need your
requirement.
Right, you too?
No, that was for you, Carmen. Oh,
I was going to go ahead and own up to it. I was going to go ahead and own up to it. I need help, Dr. Willis, in that area. I'll be the first to admit, I put that I want to make sure I ask this self-care because I am the culprit of not doing that well. So talk to us about that hard stop and send me the good vibes on that.
Okay, I'm sending you good vibes right now. It is difficult because I struggle with it too. It's like, oh, I just got to send one more email, one more call. But guess what? It'll be there in the morning. It'll be there in the morning. And you need that shut eye because that's when we rejuvenate ourselves, when we actually sleep, or even if we just have downtime. We're not doing anything. We're not talking on the phone. We're just relaxing. And that's critical, particularly right now, since we're always staring at the screen and we're never disconnected because, you know, sometimes like, oh, I have more time to work. I have more time to do this. I can do that. I can do that. But we have to find that time for self-care. So a lot of the things that Sally said resonated with me because I have a saying on my door that says, you know, self-care isn't going away to a spa when you actually have like a breakdown. And now you have to go away for like 5 days to get yourself back together. But it's day-to-day, everyday choices that you build upon. I really like that. I need to get that book. But I think that's so critical. And I even practiced that with one of my coaching clients. I said, okay, let's practice. Somebody calls you on the phone and then you have a meeting and you really can't talk. You say, okay, I have 5 minutes. And it's a hard stop because I have to move on to my next task. So we actually practice that because we all struggle with how do we break that up and say, hey, I don't have time for this right now, but I do want to talk to you. When can we schedule another call? So yeah, it's very critical. Thanks for those comments, Sam. I think I'm going to check out that book.
Absolutely. All right. So Amy, I know you have something profound to say about that.
That's a lot of pressure, Carmen. Well, to build on something Rhonda said, we say in our house, you can't mani-pedi your way into happiness or sanity or anything else. I think as women, we get the message that if we can just, you know, get that massage booked and go lay down with our face in the donut for an hour, that somehow that's going to make all the problems go away. And it doesn't. And I've found, Rhonda, you said, you know, just stopping. What a luxury to be able to just sit for 15 minutes in the morning with my cup of tea. Sometimes I sit down to journal And I decide I'm not even going to journal. I'm just going to sit and just enjoy the sunlight coming in the windows and the dog snoring on the couch and how much I love the house I'm in and just sort of enjoy. And that feels, that process of slowing down has been so valuable to me. And even my husband and I hold adventure as a very high value as a couple. And we really, really like to travel. And obviously that's been a challenge. Last year in the fall, we went on a road trip and drove from LA all the way up to Seattle and then down the coast, which was spectacular. And we had time in our calendar booked for the last 2 weeks in March. And I realized that I didn't, as fun as that was, and we were talking about maybe driving Route 66 to Chicago, I realized what I really wanted to do was sit still. I didn't want to plan a bunch of stuff. I didn't want to go from here to there and map 300 miles a day of how much we could drive. I just want to sit still and be quiet and slow down and give myself that space. And so that has become self-care in a way that it wasn't before. I also had to replace adventure with creativity, because that was a way to kind of feed that need to experience new things. And so I've started embroidering and watercolor painting and things that I still look at myself from outside myself and go, what is it that you're doing? You're just, that is the craziest hobby for you to pick up. What a weird thing. But it's been real fulfilling for me to stop and be creative and play with color and do things that get me out of my work brain. So that has become a form of self-care as well that has really helped me in the last year, and things that I'll continue as we move forward.
Sorry, I had my muted. That is so great. I love that you said you cannot mani-pedi your way. Oh my gosh.
Amy, that spoke to me. While there is a lot of truth to that, it does not hurt for me to try.
I love it. So Sarah, what do you do to self-care? Because that is so mani-pedi. You can't do that. So what do you do?
So I think that's hilarious. I actually had a manicure about 2 weeks ago for the first time in like years. That's not my go-to by any means. For me, I would say that the biggest thing that I do for self-care is like starting my day off in the energy and the mental space to support like a productive day and a fulfilling day and an effective use of my time. So as some of the other ladies were saying, like I have, you know, quite an extensive, I guess, morning routine where the first few hours of my day, I would say like first 2 to 3 hours of my day is all focused on me. And I incorporate journaling and I incorporate meditation and a bit of prayer. And then I do study on personal development and like going intrinsically inside of myself very early in the morning, like before the world is awake and before anyone has a chance to bother me. And I set intentions, and like one of the things like Carmen, you and I have spoken about is how I set intentions before every meeting that I attend, but like on a broader scale, setting an intention for the day of like, what do I want to accomplish today? And like doing that before I get started in the do of running a business. And that for me really helps. And it, you know, if you kind of like set yourself off on the right foot, the rest of the day flows a little bit easier. And then I try to do the same thing at night, right before I go to sleep. You know, do a little bit of a review of the day. And like by little, I mean like very quick. I maybe spend a minute on that. Like it's not a lot of time. And then making sure that I feel good about what I accomplished before I go to bed so that the next morning I'm not waking up feeling stressed out or anxious about, oh, I didn't do this, I didn't do that, or I have to do all these things today, right? So managing my time in that sense and being very, very mindful of, you know, how I'm showing up and how I take care of myself.
Right. Well, you know, you're right. You and I have discussed that before. And I have to remember, set intentions. That was speaking to me. Set intentions. And I love that. So, Dr. Taylor, I know you have something great to add to this too, because that is, as I said when we started this question, that is the one thing we all need mentoring on, right? Self-care. So what about you?
I have some hard stops in my life. At 8 p.m., if you are not family, my phone does not ring. I don't get a message that comes through. I set that on my phone quite a while back and I have kept to it. So anytime 8 and after, if you are not immediate family, I don't get a call or message from you. Unless I go in and check my phone to go look, and I don't. 8 p.m. is family time. And then there's some time when, you know, it's right before bed and the kiddos asleep and it's my time. I pray. That's an important part of life for me. It's making time for prayer and feeling that, okay, I'm okay with God and it feels like God's okay with me. So I feel better about the day. And then exercise. Exercise has been huge for me throughout this pandemic. Whether I'm going outside to go walk or run, or very recently I started trying to go back into the gym. But exercise has been a big part of maintaining my own mental health and getting a space that's okay. I feel good. Every time you finish that workout, you know, you just feel better and ready for the day. So it's time at night to myself and then time to myself, usually on Sundays. I don't do anything that's related to work. I'm not picking up anything related to work. It's my day, it's family day, and it's time for me.
Oh gosh, that is so true. You have to have those hard stops for family and so forth. I didn't forget you, Dr. Sapp, because I know I was looking at you going, you have something. Share it with us, Dr. Sapp.
Oh, goodness. I knew you didn't forget me. Just listening at everyone else and a lot of the things that a lot of the ladies brought up, I do. From writing in my journal that's right here next to me because I keep it everywhere I go. And that's kind of those moments when I have those hard stops where I go to my journal and just spend some time with myself. Outside of that, listening to my gospel music. That's kind of how I start my day every morning. I wake up, I turn on my gospel music, I get dressed for work. Any phone calls that I need to make, I make during that time. Any calls coming in typically doesn't happen. And I listen at my gospel music to get myself kind of in this place where I feel centered, where I feel that I'm ready to take on that day and be productive and feel confident in myself. Outside of that, spending time with my family, spending time doing things that I enjoy doing, I think is so important. A lot of times I find that I get distracted a lot of times because other people have things that they want to be done or, hey, let's go do this, let's go do that. But being able to have those established boundaries, being able to say, you know what, it's okay for me to say no, it's okay for me to do the things that I am wanting to do for myself. I am that person that will go get a massage, like go hide out from the world. Nobody knows where I'm at. And I'm at the massage parlor getting a massage. And that's kind of my space. But I do love what you said too, Amy, that you can't mani-pedi your way. So I'm going to have to use that sometimes too, and keep that, remind myself of that as well, that I have to do other things too. But my biggest thing is my journal. It's my safe space. It's my place where I can search from within inside of me, and I can gain the clarity that I need, not just about what's going on around me, but what's going on inside of me.
Indeed, indeed. So we're coming close to the end. So let's try to, for the panelists, let's do some closing thoughts. And I will just ask, because as women, you know, we always have something profound. So what would you like to leave us with that you think would totally impact us? And I don't, it doesn't need to be, it could be a one word or whatever, but I'd like you guys to leave the, not only the those of us that are present, but when others that will be listening to this, leave them with something from you. So what would that be? And I'll start with Rhondra.
That's a lot of pressure, Carmen.
I know, right?
I had something very, very simple I've been using with my clients, and Dr. Taylor mentioned earlier, live with intention. I think that's a common theme that everybody said here, you know, in order to maintain ourselves and to be present, live with intention. Why am I doing this? Does it matter? Should I be doing this? So mine is very simple, live with intention.
Okay, live with intention. All right, let's see, Miss Amy. What are you going to leave us with?
Thank you for having me on with this amazing panel of women. I appreciate it. To build on what Rhonda said, there's a through line that I'm hearing in a lot of what these women have shared about being really clear on your values. And I am such a big proponent of doing the work. I do it annually, really intensely, and then quarterly I review what I've defined as my values for the year, and they change. So I think it's really important to continue to review them. For some people, there are certain values that might be rocks. I would guess that for based on what Dr. April has said, and Shanice and Dr. Rhonda, that family would be a real strong value for you guys. Faith for some of you is obviously a consistent theme. But there are also others, community and service. There's a wonderful, if you just Google Brene Brown and her values sheet, a values exercise can just be a page of all of these words, and you spend time going through and marking each of them that really resonates with you. And for a lot of people, they find that there may be four or five that are prime values, and then there are other values that are sort of attached to those. And when I'm really clear on my values, those become my guiding stars to every decision that I make on a daily, on a weekly, on an annual basis. They're a filter that I can use to decide if I want to take on a new project. They're a filter I can use to figure out why a relationship is uncomfortable for me, or a project is uncomfortable for me, and maybe I don't want to be involved in it. Most times it's because there's something about it that's not aligned for me. And so if you haven't done that work, I highly, highly, highly encourage it, because for me, it's informed every corner of my life and made it and given me clarity in terms of how I engage in relationships and how I make decisions.
Wow. See, I knew you would do that.
Brene Brown is a gem.
That's right. Dr. Sapp, what are you going to leave us with?
So I'm going to kind of leave you all with my acronym that I'm using for this year. And it kind of takes what Dr. Rhonda has already said, Amy and Dr. April as well. But it's Be Fine. And FINE stands for focused, intentional, noble, and empowered. So I want to encourage all of the women here today during this year, be fine.
Wow, that's amazing. All right, so Sarah, what are you leaving us with?
So what came to mind for me is a concept that I've learned about leadership is that leaders leave everyone else with an impression of increase, like leaving everyone else that I come in contact with on a daily basis better off than where I found them, right? So I hope that anything that I said today has left some sort of impact, and that I left everybody here better off than they were before today.
Indeed you did. Thank you so much, Sarah. Dr. Taylor, what are you leaving us with?
You're worth it. I think as women, sometimes we don't know our own worth. We don't feel confident in the same space. We don't, a little of what Amy said, we don't know our value and how much we bring to the table. And we are so worth it. It's a beautiful group of people, confident, and we're worth every opportunity that comes our way and every goal that we decide to pursue. We can't have it all at the same time, but we can certainly try for it for as much of it as we want.
Wow. Know your worth. Well, I think I knew that you guys would all leave us with something profound. I can't tell you how grateful we are. When Dr. McGill and I talked about this, she had this bright idea to get all these women together. So I thank all of you. I thank Dr. Bird for introducing me to several of you, Dr. Mary Kay Chess, but also my friends that have joined as well, Ms. Rhonda, Amy, and Sarah. Thank everybody for taking part in this, because I do believe, just like Sarah said, that I leave you with something. And for those of you that are joining us, certainly you can put your questions in. And if you'd like them addressed from anyone on the panel, I certainly will make sure, Dr. McGill and I will make sure that happens. but I want to just tell everyone out there that we're going to, since this is being recorded, we will have this available to share with you. Dr. Long, our president, is on the call here. He's hiding from us, but he is here, and he and I host a show called Saybrook Insights, and so this will be part of the Saybrook Insights. Dr. Long, since you're typing, would you put the URL that they can find the show? And we will send out the link on our different social media as well, and certainly individually to our panelists. So I want to make sure that you guys all know that we will hear this again. There were so many sayings and takeaways. This will be probably one of our best listened to and re-reviewed. So we encourage you, once you get the links, to share it again. But again, thank you so much for your kindness to do this for us. But also, we took away so much just from the wisdom and the value that you all brought today. So I'd like to thank you so, so very much. Dr. McGill, would you like to close us out?
Sure. I just wanted to echo what Carmen shared. Thank you all so much for your time and sharing your wisdom with us and helping to, you know, really give us some food for thought. And I saw someone in the chat saying they feel inspired and invigorated to move forward and continue the work. So thank you so much. And especially Dr. Sapp, you said the FINE acronym. So now that has a new meaning for me when I tell someone I'm fine. That's like a little hidden jewel for me right here that will really speak to how I'm feeling for that day and being intentional as we set forward in our journey. So thank you all very much for your time today, and enjoy the rest of your evening, everyone. Thank you.
All right. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.